So we have the privilege and honor to be speaking with Marek Kofigani, who has just declared his intention to run as an independent candidate for president of Ghana. You're welcome to GH News Now, Marek.
Thank you very much, Kweku. I appreciate being here.
Okay. So first of all, let's get straight to brass tacks. What inspired you?
Marek is a Ghanaian. I always like to clarify that first and foremost. I'm no different from any other Ghanaian. I'm very Ghanaian. And I love my country. I love the prospects that Ghana has, and all I'm about is to make sure we get the best out of those prospects. So I am just like any ordinary Ghanaian. I identify with every other Ghanaian. That's me. I've lived in Ghana most of my life, traveled abroad a bit, come back. And so I am through and through what you can call both Ghanaian and somebody who has a perspective on what the world is about and what direction the world is going. So that's largely me. I'm 45 years old now, or actually just about turning 45 years old. I'm a chartered accountant. Started off in chartered accountancy, practiced in Ghana before I left for the UK. And then I practiced a bit in diplomacy with the Commonwealth of Nations Secretariat in the UK, and then moved on into international development. And I think in the last 2 years, after my last major work in the conflict-sensitive South Sudan, I have largely been involved in lecturing in public financial management, or some aspects of public financial management within the UK alone, globally. So that's just a bit about me.
Mm. Awesome. But what really pricked you? What made you feel like they're not doing the job right? I am going to do a better job.
It's not so much, I don't like saying I am going to do a better job. So the way I like, because I'm not going to be working alone, if you get what I mean. So my idea of doing a better job is getting the best team possible, available, the best brains we have, and we do have the best brains out there who are Ghanaians and who feel passionately about Ghana. And my agenda is to draw them in, and we do have some of them already in the pipeline, is to draw them in and say, look, this is what we've inherited. We can hand this over back to our kids because it just ain't right. And to say, you know what, we've got what it takes to move this somewhat a lot more forward than it was handed to us before we hand over to our kids. Because here's the thing for me, I met my grandpa. I had stories from him about how things were when they were kids around Nkrumah's time, and then subsequently the subsequent government, and it looked all brilliant to me, looked all good to me. But then the story changed when I was hearing my father tell his side of the story, and then things started not looking too good. Eventually, he decided we left the country to Nigeria, came back, and then it was my turn now. I'm turned 40, and I look around and I ask myself, okay, hold on here. What story am I really going to tell my kids? And I just realized, then it hit me, you know, because I work around with the youth a lot since I've been back in Ghana. And I just realized, hold on, they're really airing a good story to tell here subsequently. And the more we all sit down and just pretend, oh, it's going to get better, it will not get better. It hasn't gotten better in the last 36 years. So for me, it wasn't somewhat some artificial motivation somewhere. It was just the reality that hit home, that if we don't get it done now, it probably would never get done. Mm. And so that, for me, largely has been the motivation to all of this.
I see. So what kind of philosophy do you adhere to? I hear people saying they are Dankwa Buzia is, they are Nkrumah is, they are whatever else is. Where do you lean?
Where do I lean?
Mm-hmm.
I lean towards Ghana.
Mm. Does that is
it
that?
It can't be more than that. I lean towards Ghana.
But what is Ghana though? Because
But here's the thing: Ghana is bigger than any tradition. Ghana is bigger than the Busia tradition. It's bigger than the Nkrumah tradition. Yes, we may have studied, you know, Nkrumah. We may have studied Dankwa and the Busia tradition. We may have studied all the other traditions. But that is because it should inform us what has been in the past, and therefore determine where we want to go. So yes, those histories are crucial, but the country has evolved, and we need to recognize that. The era of Nkrumah churned out Nkrumah, and it was best for that era. We're in the 21st century. A lot has happened. Our demography has changed wildly. The kind of society we deal with now is not the kind of society the Busias and Nkrumahs dealt with. The globe in which we are immersed as a country has totally changed. And so all the parameters that would define holding on to a particular tradition has changed. And so for me, I feel the only thing that hasn't changed largely is the fact that Ghana is still here. And so if we can focus on the fact that we're doing this or we want to do this for our country, then we don't get stifled by ideologies that say, oh, you may want to do this, but it's not the Dankwa tradition. Mm. You may want to do this, but it's not the Nkrumah tradition.
I get you.
And so for me, I find it a lot more easier saying, you know what, Ghana is my tradition.
I get you. Okay, so what would you say is Ghana's biggest problem as we speak right now? Because you spoke about your grandfather and your father and all of that, and now the picture doesn't look as good. What is the biggest problem in your estimation?
Wow, that's a huge question. I mean, it's almost as pointing to a needle in a haystack because, you know, I think there are a number of things that have contributed to our current state. But if you pushed me to put a finger to one, I would very easily say over time we have sort of gotten to a point where we have... how do I put this in a succinct way? We have more or less. See, I always say this: there is the craft of doing politics, and then there is the professional business of running a state. What we've done over time is to sort of force the art or the craft of doing politics onto the professionalism of running a state. And so running a state has largely become a political movement or a political agenda or political operation rather than a technical, you know, decision-making, astute future planning, long-term agenda sort of process. And I think for me, that's where we've gotten it really, really wrong.
Mm. Okay, so... The economy is supposedly doing great or not, depending on who you ask. What's your assessment at this current state? What is our economy looking like?
Wow. There's a lot more we can do. Okay. And I know this has become a heated debate lately. You know, the fundamentals are looking good, but people can feel money in their pockets, and the currency keeps running around. Fundamentally, what we've missed out is that economics or development, whichever one you pick, anybody could pick anyone, but economics and development is largely about people. As long as we don't get that right, Yes, the fundamentals may be looking okay. Yes, things may on paper be looking okay. But the truth is our economy will not do well. And by that, this is what I mean. Every single country that has done well has invested in its people. And the idea behind that, whether you're looking at it from an economic perspective or a development perspective, is simple. One, you develop people, you have already, you know, sorted the issue of inclusivity. That's one. The other agenda for doing that is that by investing in people, you allow people the opportunity to be able to create their own opportunities because they have the skills and they have the systems in place to create those opportunities. What we have now is a situation where government feels that it has to employ people, the most people. And so the bit that, and which is a larger bit that government cannot employ, they stay out largely unemployed because we have not invested in people. The people cannot go out there and build the industry, whether it's light industries or heavy industries. They are built by people, and they are built by people who know how to create opportunities. So as long as we don't do that investment in people, we're always going to be here. Because as it stands now, Kweku, the truth is this. I would dare anybody to point out to me in Ghana or generally over the last 27 years how our industrialization has played out. There hasn't been any massive industrialization. Every politician comes or every government comes and all they talk about is industrialization. Where is the industrialization? Industrialization does not happen without a very thoroughly prepared group of people, a very thoroughly equipped group of people. Whether it's technical or in any other means, people have to be invested in. Whether the industries are being done in Ghana or whether foreigners are bringing their industries to Ghana, either of those would look out to do so because there are people who can get the industries running. And so is that limitation in the way we've looked at economics, we've looked at development that has really not been helpful to us?
Mm. Okay. Now, I'm happy that you touched on employment because that actually is where I'm heading right now. It seems to be a perennial problem for every government for as far back as I can remember. What are some of the strategies you have in mind to cage this monster? I think you've actually hinted a bit on it in your previous response, but if you can do like a quick summary of what your plans are.
Now I'm being careful now because now this is bordering on what my policies will likely look like. But you would appreciate, you know, I need to be careful here because we're not in campaign season. So I cannot be touting out here what my policy agenda is for employment or for.
But then again, once I hear that there's a new kid on the block and I start checking you out, I want to know what you are bringing to the table, right?
I agree. I totally agree. Which is why I've tried to summarize it earlier. The dilemma I have is that yes, I'm a new kid on the block, but that new kid has got to also ascribe to the rules that make our democracy work.
I get that. Let's skip that.
Yes.
Let's skip that. Let's move on. Sanitation. Right. Sanitation is one of the biggest issues also. So much depends on sanitation. Our tourism is in all shapes because we cannot get sanitation right. What are some basic ideas that you have to tackle that?
Sanitation, the issue of sanitation in Ghana is largely, this is the way I see it, it's largely attitude, you know. But it's also largely enforceability. Now, somebody may look at it as though, you know, it's one of those chicken before the egg thing. You don't know which one comes first, you know. But sanitation has two arms to it. To make it work, it's got to be enforced. And And to make it also work, the people who are involved, which is us as citizens, have got to embrace the fact that we also have responsibilities towards sanitation. Now, here's what I think about how public services normally work largely, is that you can expect that even if the government says everybody should bin their rubbish twice every week and all that, you can definitely expect that there will be people in there who will not get it done. That's just the nature of citizenry. The question then rises up, will there be some level of enforcement to even out those elements within the citizenry that just do not adhere to what the government of the day says should be done? Now, so for me, I think there are two elements there that need tackling. And the one that we have the most control over is enforcement.
Mm. Okay. But let me push you a bit on that. Enforcement.
Sure.
You need the infrastructure in place, right? If you say people should bin their waste and all of that, you need a certain structure where...
I agree.
The way it's done.
I agree.
So
yeah, I agree. So you're talking about there should be vans to pick up bins. There should be
all of that
garbage dustbins everywhere.
All of that
for people to, you know.
Yes, all of that. And this could be, if you ask me, this could be done by government, or it could also be kind of like handed over to the private sector with government support to do that.
I agree. I mean, I think largely currently, you know, it's the private sector that is involved in sanitation in terms of delivering the equipment and the infrastructure to make sure sanitation happens. I think the larger question is whether or not, because currently there's largely just, I mean, in the list of the big players, there's largely just one, you know, Zion that is largely... the player in the sanitation. So
yeah.
The question rather is whether or not, it is constrained in taking care of sanitation, nationally. I think that's the bigger question. So, yes, I agree that, it needs some support. And I think they have gotten support. I think the real issue is, whether they are able to satisfy the entire capacity or whether we do need to introduce new players into the process.
Mm.
I know there are all these little smaller, borough boy sanitation trucks that go around, but and I know we've tried, all the governments, either of them have tried.
Do you think it should be localized?
Do
you think it will work better if it's localized? If, say, in, say, this district, there is one company that is in charge of that, rather than have one player taking care of the whole country?
Oh, yeah, no, I can see why that will work. Because, I mean, I can see why your suggestion will work. And I'll tell you why I think it will work. Because on the one hand, you have a local player who truly understands the local circumstance.
Exactly.
That's one. But you also, in the process, are also creating local employment. That's
mm-hmm.
two.
Mm-hmm.
So I can see why that will work. But it also takes me back to the very point I was making, which is that whether or not the one person we have now has the capacity.
Yep.
If you get what I mean.
I get what you mean.
It really is about capacity, if you look at it that either way.
Sure.
It really, for me, is about capacity.
Okay. Now, let's move on. Security. On the home front, we hear about kidnappings, brazen vigilantism, general lawlessness. On the international front, however, we seem to be insulated from the terrorism that we read about a lot in the foreign media. This, I think, is more chance than strategy. What is your general idea for dealing with security home and abroad?
Right. So, I mean, the issue of vigilantism is sadly the case, but that's an issue for the political parties because they derive their legitimacy from the political parties who formed them.
Mm.
So for me, I've always taken the position that why is it that the political parties have formed these groups and yet it is the public that is being required to be involved in, you know, trying to work towards this group? It doesn't make sense to me. You know, they don't derive their legitimacy from the public. They derive it... Sorry, I may have lost you there. Hello?
Yeah, yeah. I lost you for a quick minute.
Okay. Right. So, the depending on where these vigilantes derive their legitimacy, that should be the point from which they need to be dismantled. I can only hope that they are, because apparently the process are talking to each other to make things happen. So we can only hope that that process goes all the way and that these disbandments happen, bearing in mind that there will be issues around how do they get absorbed as soon as the disbandment happens. Now, that, unfortunately, in as much as, you know, they were formed by the parties, the subsequent outflows from the disbandment will be a public issue and have to be considered and addressed accordingly.
Okay.
You know, we could look at it in different ways, you know, depending, you know, we can decide, can we channel them into a grid? Can we channel them into national development processes? But there are options that I think can be looked at in terms of those actually within those groups. In the case of, you know, international security and threats from, terrorism and all that, there's two things I want to say. One is that terrorists behave like business people. They have got to have a vested interest why they want to carry out terrorist activities in a certain area, and whether or not by carrying it out in that area, they are able to either send a message to whoever they need to send it to, or that it ends up, you know, whether financially or otherwise, in their favor. That's how terrorists work. And so I'm not sure whether to call it chance or not, but what I do believe is that it does not appear that we have given any terrorist activity or organization a reason to be beneficial to their activities. It does not, however, mean that we should ignore the threats of them, because the threats are all over. What does concern me, however, is that if we keep unemployment rising at the rates that they are, or even at the level that they are, we would soon very likely start to see that, you know, disgruntled youth might just offer terrorists a breeding space. And so that is crucial for me, and that at all times that we're not going to, you can't get an unemployment level at zero. That's impossible. But at all times that unemployment is kept to a very minimal level. The other thing that I don't think we look at quite very intentionally is that, and again, because we don't appear to be a threat, but it's inherent itself a threat because we don't see ourselves as that, is that our internet spaces need to be very well protected, because that's the new playground for terrorism, really. Whether it's financial terrorism or economic terrorism, as they call it. So, you know, we can look at it from different perspectives, but I wouldn't say it's a chance. I think there is still a very valid threat. It might not be a threat at the same level as it is to the U.S. because of its wider international engagement, or like a threat to the U.K. because of its wider international engagement. But we nevertheless do have that threat sitting in there. It really is just a matter of whether or not we start affecting the world on a larger scale.
Okay.
And then that those threats can escalate.
Okay. Now let's touch on agriculture for a quick second. The Parliament has ratified the Plant Breeders Bill, which basically opens the doors for GM foods to flood into Ghana. And my concern really is that under the guise of trying to provide copyright for plant breeders, if you look at the fine print, what it really is doing is giving international organizations like, or multinational corporations, I should say, like Monsanto and all the rest, to really come in and introduce certain types of foods, which we know other countries are very worried about. We've seen the effects, and we've seen the reason why countries like Australia, Canada, the UK, etc., are very protective of their food source.
Yes.
What do you think of this whole issue, and what would you do to protect the Ghanaian farmer from these threats, and the consumer too, of course?
I must be honest. I have heard of the bill. I have not read the very fine details of it. But you know, so yes, the bills are passed. They become, you know, operational. But let's not forget that there are also operational regulations that go with most of the bills that are passed by Parliament. So. The fact that the bill has passed through Parliament, I don't want to believe automatically means that the floodgates have been opened. Granted, yes, it is becoming, it will become more possible now. But I want to believe that there also will be regulations, either in this case directly being structured by the Ministry of Agriculture, that would regulate, you know, what eventually gets planted.
Sorry to intervene, but I doubt that very much, which is one of my concerns. If you look at the fine print, there is a clause, for instance, which says that Parliament cannot undo the ratification of the bill. The President cannot undo it, basically saying that nobody can undo it. And that is cause for concern. But since you say you haven't looked at the fine detail, maybe let's leave this.
Yes, I will need to look into the fine details.
Let's leave this particular question for our next interview, which hopefully should be happening.
Thank you.
And then let's still on agriculture though. Marijuana, it's something that. Okay, you saw it coming, didn't you? Certain countries have
my friends and I have had conversations around this several times, but yeah, go on,
it's
please.
About time to bring it out in the open. Certain countries have legalized it with massive benefits.
Yeah.
Now a country like Ghana has great potential to benefit from the legalization of marijuana, and also if you look at the other side of it, there are so many youths who are jailed for no sensible reason, if you ask me, for probably possessing like a gram of marijuana. Their youth is taken away, and the government spends money keeping them in jail.
Right.
What do you think we should do with this case?
I feel very trapped here. Marijuana. This is my position on marijuana. If it is just about the agricultural component of it, you know, that we can grow very high quality marijuana and whether we can process or not is a different thing. But even if we cannot, to export it, that is a sound argument, because we have the fertility of the soil to grow marijuana. People have privately grown marijuana here for decades. So that is not an argument. And for me, if that is all there is or there was to it, there wouldn't have been a problem. The jurisdictions that have done well so far with the marijuana is that, for me, is because they also side by side have very strong regulatory systems around not only the growth of the marijuana but the use of the marijuana. And so in as much as we could easily have said, you know what, let's do the Greek side of it and ship it out, we do have to be certain that before that happens, that we've got our regulatory, our enforcement procedures and systems very strongly working. Besides that, we also have to be sure that we have our health structures that may have to deal with anything marijuana related on a large scale also working. So I don't dispute the fact that economically it sounds good and it is doable. What I do want to, and which might take some looking into, is to determine whether, you know what, with the structures we have in place, we could do it at all, or with the structures we have in place, we could do it on a restricted level. And then, as it is growing, we can develop the other areas that can make us expand. So if you ask me whether we should be farming marijuana at all, my position is that it is possible, but it will need some very careful assessment. Now, even granted the assessment has happened, if the assessment shows that it is workable, I would love to have it done on a test basis, on an experimental basis, by which point we would say in about 3 or 4 years know what it takes to have it done, and therefore, you know, make it, then we can expand on a more commercial level. So it's neither here nor there, but I do think it has potential for agricultural
export. So let me engage you a little further. Exactly. Let me engage you a little further. People are using marijuana, take it or leave it. And what's going on is that it's like apatashi, right? Back in the day, I don't know if your grandpa told you this as well, but back in the day, apatashi was a contraband substance. And people had to hide. That's actually why it's called apatashi. Akekpatashi, you know, you hide it.
Yes, okay. Yes. That's a bit of history lesson.
You know, and eventually it was freed, and people are actually, it's an industry right now. Right now, people are actually packaging
aquatashi.
Exactly. Exactly, and people are actually packaging it for export. I've seen sachet aquatashi and all of that. You know,
what I remember those even as a kid, the sachet ones.
Yes. So what the argument is right now would be that instead of having some shady people trading in marijuana and keeping the government from getting any revenue from it at all, how about bringing it out in the open so that people can freely grow it, and then the government can tax, you know, them and also make some revenue from it. You know, and then the other side of it is that people are getting jailed for it, and actually that's the point which I really need you to address. What do you think about that? Do you think people who are non-violent people who have been put in jail for minimal amounts of marijuana should be freed?
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, I need to check this because I want to believe there should be a minimal level of marijuana that actually not. I think it's a banned substance in Ghana, isn't it? I think it's an entirely banned substance in Ghana. So if that is still the case, then maybe the law requires itself to, and this is the thing I've always had with our laws, that it requires itself to evolve with the people because, look, we cannot, like you said, we cannot pretend this is not happening. Mm. But we must also, as a people, care for the lives and the livelihoods or the health of our citizenry. So I think it will require some level of balanced relook at the law in order to determine whether or not, you know what, can we say up to a certain grams of this, it's okay to have. And then beyond a certain grammage, you are stepping beyond the boundaries of the law and therefore can be punished. So yes, if it is still in the law that, you know, it's an entirely banned substance, then yes, we do need to relook at that.
Definitely. And may I also suggest that this law kind of tends to hurt poor people the more. Rich people hardly go to jail for smoking or using marijuana. Poor people get arrested and they get put in jail and they can't even afford bail. Anyway, let's move on. So I'm and once again you've taken the lead into where I was going next. The legal system in Ghana. Do you think we need to look at the legal system in Ghana, the way it's operating, and make sure that it works for more people than it is doing right now?
I know the legal for years been somewhat slow in the way it delivers. But I also know that there has been some level of progress quite recently in trying to systematize the way the legal system works. So I know currently there's been some production of some softwares to help in my cases, which for many years have been transparent, if you've ever been to the legal system. So I know it's slow in the past. I also know that, some things are happening. Perhaps changes may not have been enough, but they have come. I don't know how deep the changes turned out, but I know some changes are. What is rather of concern to me, and I don't know how far this has changed since I last went through any legal process, is the fact that we cannot run away from the fact that, law is not, and we can walk away from that. That happens in life. So if there is anything that is rather a worry to me on the legal side, it's not the sense at all. It's the constitutional side of the legal, which I feel needs quite a level of and that is not to say that we haven't had constitutional reviews. At least we have had two constitutional reviews. And now that we have a deal, for example, it's taken more than a decade. I think it's our constitution, which is the side of the legalities that need to be re-looked at, and re-looked at quite intensely. And if anything, that is the area I would focus on in terms of, getting the constitution to now reflect the new Ghana we have. Ghana has evolved a lot since the constitution was last written.
Okay. Now, my next few questions are kind of policy related, so I will also keep those for our next interview and just go on to ask you finally, how do you assess your chances of winning, especially running as an independent candidate in a system which knows basically NDC and NPP? And what are you going to do different from what we're used to?
Now, most people would say it is unrealistic to say you are in it with it. And the question I immediately pose is, I don't recognize the reality of that, but the question I always pose is, well, not. Because, see, and I like the introduction to the question you made, but you seem to either intentionally missing or can't see happening, is the fact that, look, the demography of has changed. That's one. Two, there's a huge level of women empowerment happening, and we can't run that. Women empowering women. It's phenomenal, and we cannot pretend it's not happening. That's two. The other thing we recognize is that a lot of it, and just right from the fact that people now believe they have tasted both the NDC and the MPP. Look, this is anything. I like not comparing facts because it looks a bit outside of our jurisdiction, continent wise, but it has happened. So people are changing their said, people are reacting to politics differently. People look at them as they want to. So, so these are quite fundamental changes that we cannot ignore and say will not have an impact on election 2020. So, the chances are, all I can say for now is that my involvement in this process will definitely cause a whatever disruption will be, but it will definitely, most certainly, I hope, be a disruption that will be noticed.
Thank you very much, Marik Kofi Ghani. Independent, I don't know if I can call you independent candidate yet, because, like you said, the campaign...
Aspirant.
Okay. So, thank you very much for your time. And like I said, this hopefully will be the first of many interviews until November of 2020 and beyond. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Coco.